Every sport has its legends, stories of victories or upsets that fans come back to again and again over beers at the corner pub. For soccer fans, one of those legendary events was the 1966 World Cup, when an underdog team from North Korea defeated Italy. The North Koreans became the stars of the Cup, even after losing to Portugal in the quarterfinals. They then returned to North Korea and were never heard from again. Now filmmakers Dan Gordon and Nick Bonner tell their story in the new documentary, The Game of Their Lives. Gordon and Bonner spent 5 years tracking down the players and working to get permission from the North Korean government to film in private homes, which the Western press rarely has access to. They found that the story of this long-ago soccer match has political dimensions that resonate today, in this period of rising tensions between the U.S. and North Korea. Just to get a sense of how exciting this encounter was, let's listen to the moment that turned the 1966 World Cup game North Korea versus Italy. Dan, can you give us an idea of just how legendary this 1966 upset was? Is this a story that you hear soccer fans tell all the time?
Yeah, this is quite well known as the greatest shock in World Cup history. It's really a story that I knew a lot about just in the bare fact of the Koreans beat Italy 1-0, legendary game in 1966 in Middlesbrough, which is in the northeast of England. That story is quite legendary, and also what's legendary is that the Italians were so shamed on their return that they returned to a hail of rotten tomatoes from their fans.
Well, let's talk about the game first and the circumstances for it. How did this North Korean soccer team come to qualify for the World Cup in 1966 in the first place? I mean, this is only, 13 years after the Korean War, and they didn't have diplomatic relations with the sponsoring countries, did they?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite... the more we researched the story, the more we realised it was far more than just, you know, one match in Middlesbrough. They qualified by playing Australia in a playoff game. The qualification at that time, there was only one place open to Africa, Asia and Oceania. It was a very, very dominated by South America and Europe, the World Cup at that time. And all the African nations withdrew as a boycott, which then led to them getting a place at the 1970 World Cup. So it left South Korea, North Korea and Australia. And because North and South didn't want to play each other, the South actually withdrew. So it left two teams to qualify for one place. And in football parlance, they murdered them. They won 9-2 on aggregate, 6-1 and 3-1. And that was a huge shock because the Australians were made up of mainly British players who had been lower league players but still professional, and they saw it as their opportunity to return home, to go back to England and play in the World Cup finals for Australia. So that was a huge shock.
Now, I think you say the average height of the North Korean players was, about 5'5"?
5'5", yeah.
And the first game they had to play before they played the Chile and the Italians were the USSR, the Russians.
Yeah.
They must have towered over them, the Russians.
Yeah, and they did. And the again, we didn't know this until we looked more into the research side of things, but they had actually gone on a tour of Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in the August before the World Cup. And they played some of the best teams in Russia and beaten them, and the way they'd beaten them was with their speed and their the nimbleness and their skill, and the Russians aren't certainly weren't stupid, and they learnt from that and they realised that they've got this enormous physical presence, and whilst the North Koreans weren't scared, they were certainly beaten, well and truly beaten round. I think there was a foul every 3 minutes, which is for that time is quite a. And well, even for now, it's quite an exceptional foul rate. And they weren't just niggly fouls; they were smashed around the pitch. And but the amazing thing is, I mean, they were well built, the Koreans, just on a slightly smaller scale than the Russians. So they certainly didn't. I think the amazing thing is, in England, people thought, well, we've wondered what these Koreans are like, and now we've seen they're not really up to much. But the Koreans themselves said they went back to the dressing room or locker room, as it is in America, and they said, right, well, we've been defeated, but we've still got two more games to play, and we'll show people.
Now, this Russian game was played in Middlesbrough, and apparently the townspeople of this northeast town in England just went crazy over the North Koreans. How fanatical did they get?
Initially, they were disappointed that it was going to be the North Koreans based in Middlesbrough rather than, you know, a more glamorous side like Italy. But then there was this huge curiosity about these little men, and you know, again, some of the media had sort of said, you know, they'd be little evil communists and, you know, really hard. And when they met them, the townspeople went to see them train. They realised immediately that, you know, these were really, really nice people and you know, we'll get behind them. Then they got the sympathy vote after the Russia game. And then suddenly it just seemed to turn in the Chile game that the crowd was screaming and chanting and you know, screaming for Korea. And at that time, that didn't really happen in the English leagues. And as the, you know, the BBC commentator says, you know, they've never cheered Middlesbrough like this for years here. And it is incredible that they just seem that the people just seem to be carried along with this fervour that was developing. And they did completely identify with these North Koreans as their team.
Let's talk about the famed game against Italy. How'd the game shape up, and how good was the Italian team in 1966?
Well, the Italian team was one of the favourites for the tournament. They were a young team, and they would win the European Championships 2 years later, and they would be the runners-up at the World Cup in 1970. And they were full. Fichetti was an incredible player, and Mazzola was a real leader, and Rivera, you know, was the golden ball winner, which is like the most valuable player in Europe. So they were on or should have been on a real high, but I think they approached the World Cup quite nonchalantly. They assumed that they would easily get through this group and they'd probably, you know, win all three games. And the easiest thing was that, you know, they beat Chile in their first game, and they thought they would then beat Russia and stroll, you know, play a reserve side against North Korea and still stroll through. They actually lost to Russia in their second game, so. There was a number of things that were going wrong within the camp. There was a lot of disquiet, and the manager, Fabbri, you know, he recognised it in the local papers. He said, you know, my players have lost faith in themselves. So you got this real, you know, Italian crisis within themselves and a fading of confidence. And in the meantime, the Koreans were getting better and better. They'd lost their first game. They drew the second with this amazing last-minute equaliser. And they approached the game thinking, yes, we're going to win. But again, I think the Italians did approach the game thinking, well, we only need to draw. You know, if we tie the game, then that's good enough. And they kind of, there's a big, you know, no one ever learns from history, but so many teams have approached a game thinking, we only need to tie this game and we'll be fine, and they end up losing and going home. And that's what happened. The Italians started amazingly well. Ri Chamyong, the goalkeeper, was in really, really fine form and saved lots of shots, and the Italians missed. Then their captain was injured and taken off, and there were no replacement players at that time. And slowly you could see that the Italian players lose heart, and the Koreans gaining confidence. And then, Pak De Wijk scored this legendary goal 4 minutes before half-time. And then they held on in the second half. And it's amazing. You can see, you know, and the BBC commentator says, you know, they've won. Good heavens, they've won. And, you know, it was the greatest shock in World Cup history. Now, the Koreans say they weren't shocked by it. They believed they would win. But in Italy, it still remains a national disgrace. And in fact, you know, it's still known. If anything goes wrong in Italy, they call it another Korea. And that's the extent to which the Italians sort of, you know, they still suffer for that fateful day, July the 19th, 66.
Now, a big part of this story and part of the mystery and the mystique of it is due to the fact that these extraordinary players went back to Korea and virtually disappeared to the West and to the world of sports. And you point out that in the film that there were rumors about what happened to them when they returned. After they beat Italy, they lost in the quarterfinals to Portugal. And what were the rumors? Were they censored punished in some way for their loss?
Yeah, I mean the rumours that had spread that they'd been imprisoned, but the stories were so conflicting that we weren't really sure, you know, of their authenticity anyway. The big thing was no one had ever asked the players what had happened. And, you know, to a man, they all said, well, you know, we came home as heroes, you know, look at the footage, you'll see. And they are still regarded as heroes.
Some of the allegations were that they'd, particularly the ones that came out from England, were that they threw the Portuguese match by womanising and drinking beforehand. And we went to sort of try and find out about this theory, and we went up to Middlesbrough to see if they'd been womanising. And they're very good-looking lads. I mean, even now you get girls going, "Woohoo, what a team!" And there was actually sort of there was no incident. It's a very small town, Middlesbrough, and you'd soon know if anything had been going on there. And there were no sort of, at that time we looked in the records, there were no sort of pregnancies going on with Crane kids going around. We then went up to Liverpool to check about the drinking allegations. And much to sort of Dan and my shock, you know, the man who we interviewed, who's the original chap who ran the bar, said, "Yes, you know, they did. They drank the bar dry." And Dan and I went, "Oh no, this is awful." But oh no, soda water, and that sort of gives you an idea. I mean, they were there to play football.
Now let's talk about the making of the film, because that's a big part of this story. How did you get access to the players in their homes? It's very difficult for the press to get into people's homes in North Korea. And I understand, yeah, Nick, you have business connections in North Korea. What are they? What's the nature of your business there?
I don't know if it's really business connections. What happened is I was a landscape architect lecturing in Leeds and Sheffield University in England. And in 1993, went to Beijing to teach at one of the universities there and do some more studying. And started playing with the football with the British Embassy team. And one of the players who was an attack, I was goalkeeper, happened to be a North Korean. And for the past 10 years, we've been best mates. And we just get on very well. And then when Dan came on with this idea of making this film, the first thing I thought was, well, who is this man, Dan Gordon? No one goes into North Korea to make... if you're going to North Korea, you're going as a journalist, you're going for something certainly more than the football story. But we met up, and I spoke back to my North Korean friend and said, is it possible for us to go and see if we can find these players? And he sort of knew about the story and said, yeah, no, certainly. But even at that time, we thought we'd only have access to the most famous one, Pak Duik, and also one other, the goalkeeper, Ri Chan-myong, who was still coaching, and they'd been out with a team to Beijing beforehand. And it was from there that we that sort of initial trust. In North Korea, the reports we get are from journalists who go in, mostly Western journalists, very few journalists from South Korea get in. And of course, if they're only there for a week, there's only so much they can learn about the country. Having been there for 10 years, I've got a lot more access. And I think there's an enormous amount of trust. And so when we came in with Dan, and Dan, who actually can actually head a ball for about sort of 10 minutes in the air, we realized that, you know, I think the players very soon realized that this is an expert in football, and they relaxed, and suddenly the doors opened.
What rules and restrictions were placed on your filming? What were you allowed to show and what not?
We thought, like everyone else, I think, who questions us, that we would be wholly restricted and we wouldn't be able to do this and we wouldn't be able to do that. We got everything that we asked for and more. We were assigned two minders, as you always are when you're in North Korea, but they actually, you know, were our interpreters and really guides rather than minders. We asked to go to Pak Duik's house, we got it. We asked to go on the trams, we got it. Everything that we wanted to get, we got, which, you know, for a filmmaker is just unbelievable. You wouldn't get that sort of cooperation if I was making a film about the English World Cup team of 66. And what the amazing story is that they took a documentary crew in 1966, and I knew they had this footage, and I assumed that they would have kept it in their archive. And when we asked to see it, they showed it to us, and it was quite good, but colour, which the English TV was black and white at the time, so it was colour film from 66, and they said to us, we don't think it's good enough quality for you. We would like to take it back to negative and then reprint it to brand new colour positive. And, you know, I thought that there is no way in the world that we can afford to pay for that. And they said, no, we will give that to you because we want you to have the best possible film. And again, you wouldn't get that in England from anyone.
Now, relations are so tense right now between the U.S. and North Korea. And you two are probably among very few Westerners who have spent time in people's homes in the DPRK. So So on this tour, have you been approached by anyone from the U.S. government or from foreign relations policy organizations who want to get more of a handle on what life is, daily life is like inside North Korea?
Sadly, no. I think what is interesting, Clinton, there was what was happening in North Korea was suddenly America was not being touted as this sort of the fire-wielding enemy across the border. Madeleine Albright had been over, the various exchanges were happening. They even thought there was going to be an American cultural office set up in Pyongyang. And the rhetoric had been turned down. Now, over the last 10 years, in 1993, it was very, very serious. There was the threat, which is, in fact, 10 years later, is the exact same threat now, both from North Korea having the nuclear capability. In 1993, there was the idea that the states would go and take a strike on one of those the manufacturing bases for that. But since then, things calmed down. And when Dan and I started going in 2000, it is almost like North Korea had lost this enemy that wasn't every so often this, the Americans are responsible for this, the Americans have done this, and there was positive press. What is so sad now is that there's such pressure coming that they feel that they're getting from America that, in fact, it does is refocus them on saying, oh, yes, my gosh, there is an enemy across there. This is why we are what we're doing. Unfortunately, now it's back up to the old levels.
So when you were talking with people on this trip while filming, were you able to talk politics?
Yeah, I mean we talk everything. I mean I obviously prefer to talk football with anyone that would care to listen. But you know we talk politics, and on this trip recently, you know we were talking about the situation, and really you know we can see. You know, both sides, but from their point of view, you know, they were saying, you know, they've done the air raid drills, they've had blackout practice, they're completely ready for war, which is frightening for us, but they, you know, again, just feel like 50 years on, nothing's changed, they still have this enemy that wants to destroy them, and from their point of view, all they can see is that America wants to attack, and they're ready for it, and we think that, you know, it's such a... it's tragic, really, that we're back at square one. They say that they're not frightened, you know, of the enemy, but I'm sure that underneath it all, you know, it scares everyone that this, you know, potential standoff, you know, could end in absolute catastrophe.
So what kind of sense do you have, after making this film, about the relationship between sports and politics?
I've always believed that football, you know, will transcend all boundaries, and that certainly was the case in '66. And what we found is that it's the case now. We took the players back to Middlesbrough in October, and they were received a standing ovation from 33,000 people there. They also received a standing ovation from 40,000 at Everton. They were received by the Speaker of the House of Commons, received by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. I mean, from the highest political level to the man in the street, that they were welcomed as people, and they've never forgotten that. And to the extent that Middlesbrough is talking of twinning itself with Pyongyang and having a North Korea Day on July the 19th to commemorate that achievement, and raising the North Korean flag from the town hall. So on a people-to-people level, you know, football and sport in general actually transcends all boundaries.
It was absolutely beautiful when we took the players. I mean, Middlesbrough, to the North Koreans, is home. It's their sort of home abroad. And we walked on with the remaining players, the seven players, and we weren't too sure what the reception would be like. And just before a football match, the stadium was normally pretty empty, but we walked on, the stadium was full, and 33,000 people stood up to a man and a woman and a child, and it was the tears, it was the stuff out of movies. It was, you couldn't have asked for a more beautiful reception for them.
Yeah, and basically, I mean, Pat Duick said, you know, that the thing he took, the English people took them to their hearts. And really the most important thing he learned was that football isn't about just winning. You know, playing football wherever we go can improve diplomatic relations and help promote peace. And I think that's what, you know, a lot of our audiences have taken from the film, and really has been the main message of the film. And especially at this moment in time, that, you know, there is an alternative to the vitriol that's being spoken at the moment.
I'd like to thank both of you. I really enjoyed talking with you about soccer, about this story today. Thanks.
Thank you.
Filmmakers Dan Gordon and Nick Bonner. Their new documentary about the North Korean soccer team that made World Cup history is called The Game of Their Lives.